Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
In the hillside favelas of Rio de Janeiro, kids are playing soccer. They laugh and yell out in Portuguese. Elderly Parisians sitting at sidewalk cafes chatter in French. University students in Bucharest absorb lectures in their native Romanian. In Mexico City, TV news anchors read out the day's events in Spanish. In the bleachers of the stadium of San Siro in Milan, fans of the city's football clubs chant in Italian. 800 million people around the globe today hear the legacy of Rome every time they speak. The Latin language and its descendants, the Romance languages, are one of the Roman Empire's great legacies to the world. Some of the Romance languages, like Spanish and Portuguese, have hundreds of millions of speakers. Others, like Romanche or Gascon, have only tens or hundreds of thousands. Whether it's a sunbather on Ipanema Beach, a rice farmer in the Philippines, or a shepherd in the Apennine Mountains of Italy, their language ultimately leads back to the tongues spoken in the Italian region of Latium. All these roads lead back to Rome. But those roads take a long and winding path back through hundreds, thousands of years. Language change is a glacially slow phenomenon. We have to go back, past the works of Voltaire, Cervantes, and Dante. We have to return to the years as and after the Roman Empire fell apart in the West. What happened? How did Latin splinter into a vast array of different tongues, and why? That is what we're going to find out. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. Outside the Vatican, there aren't a whole lot of people speaking Latin these days. But Latin is still with us each and every day. We hear it in legal terminology in terms like habeas corpus. We hear it in English every time we say something like abdomen or exterior, loanwords directly from Latin. We hear it when we say revision or necessary, terms that came to English from Norman French, but which were ultimately derived from Latin. Finally, we hear Latin's children directly in the form of the Romance languages, from Spanish to Portuguese to French to Romanian and everything in between. If we head back all the way to about 400 BC, there was no reason to think that Latin would become the progenitor of all of this linguistic diversity. At that point in time, Rome was just a city on the Tiber. Latin was just one of a whole bunch of different languages in Italy. But language follows empire. As Roman military, political, and economic power expanded first over Italy and then throughout the Mediterranean and beyond, Latin went with it. By the 2nd century AD, after a couple of centuries of Roman rule, folks were speaking Latin all over the Roman Empire. You could grow up speaking Latin in Narbonne in southern France, in Mauritania right on the fringe of the Sahara Desert, in Salona, along the Adriatic in what's now Croatia, or in far-off Eboracum, what's now York in northern England. Latin had spread right along with Roman soldiers, Roman trade goods, and Roman bathhouses. Most of all, Latin had spread throughout the provinces with the Romans themselves. The Roman Empire wasn't just a political unit. It was a space, a whole interconnected world of movement. This is the fundamental fact of the Roman Empire's existence. Within its borders and beyond, goods, people, and ideas were constantly in motion. The empire drove that movement by sending soldiers all over the place and by creating demand for some kinds of goods. The empire also promoted that movement indirectly by providing the infrastructure and the environment that encouraged it. As the Roman Empire came apart in the 5th and 6th centuries, so did the linguistic unity of the Roman world. Over the following centuries and well into the Middle Ages, Latin spoken in the different parts of what had been the Western Empire split into regional varieties. Eventually, somebody born in Naples wouldn't be able to understand somebody born in Paris. So let's take a step back here. Let's lay out some basics. The most important thing to bear in mind here is that language is always changing. Grammarians and those who fancy themselves grammarians may wish that this wasn't the case. If you've ever written for a publication, you've almost certainly gotten a message castigating you for some barbarism in your language. These guardians of pure language, and bless their hearts for their efforts, are always fighting a losing battle. To change, slowly and often imperceptibly, is just the nature of language. It's just what it does. These changes take many forms. Sometimes they're changes in pronunciation. Some pronunciations might fall out of use, except in really specific places. Take the non-rhotic R of the stereotypical Boston accent, the ka pronunciation of car. That used to be much more widespread. These kinds of systematic sound shifts are called phonological change. Other times, there are shifts in the meanings of particular words. This is how literally came to double as figuratively. It's a good example. This is called semantic change. There are changes in syntax and how we put sentences together and structure them. There are changes in orthography, in how we write or spell words and sentences. These could just be a shift in how people are taught to write, or they might reflect the deeper kinds of changes that we just talked about. This isn't a comprehensive list or a comprehensive set of explanations by any means, but they're good enough for our purposes. Now, these changes can take place among particular social groups, or more commonly, in particular places. Sometimes they spread up and down the social scale, moving down through social classes from fancy aristocrats until they reach ordinary workers, or vice versa. Sometimes they seep outwards from people and places through social networks and everyday contact. This is called contagious diffusion, or the neighborhood effect. In other cases, those language innovations jump from urban center to urban center, skipping the countryside in between. This is called hierarchical diffusion, or parachuting. When we put them all together, what we get is language change in a whole bunch of different dimensions all at once. It's happening everywhere, all the time, in the speech of every single person. You don't have to be one of the greats to participate in these kinds of shifts. Every time we try out a new word or our accent shifts a bit, we're contributing to these kinds of long-term, large-scale changes. If language is always changing, does that mean language change is random? Nope. Sound change is regular and follows particular rules. When we compare languages, we can work backwards and find the features their common ancestor shared. This comparative method is how we can split languages up into families. Eventually, by working backwards, we can reconstruct the common ancestors. For, say, French and Spanish, we know the common ancestor was Latin. But what about English and German? Or Irish and Greek? Or Russian and Hindi? We don't have texts that represent their common ancestor. All these languages belong to the Indo-European language family. They share a common ancestor called Proto-Indo-European that was spoken thousands of years ago, probably on the Eurasian steppe north of the Black Sea. Within the Indo-European family, we have subfamilies. Germanic, which contains English and German, descended from Proto-Germanic. Celtic, with Irish and Welsh, along with extinct languages like Gaulish. Slavic, with Russian, Czech, and so on. And Italic, with Latin and its descendants. Language change is a glacially slow process. For example, we can still easily understand the English spoken a century ago. Listen to Teddy Roosevelt give a campaign speech in 1912.
The great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated quickly. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe that the majority of the plain people of the United States will, day in and day out, make fewer mistakes in governing themselves than any smaller class or body of men, no matter what their training, will make in trying to govern them.
And here's Winston Churchill in 1909.
I am glad to have an opportunity at this time of crisis of addressing so many thousands of people whom I cannot meet face to face. On many grounds, we may commend the budget to the country. It makes provision for the present. It makes greater provision for the future.
We don't know exactly how English would have sounded centuries ago, but here's Shakespearean actor Ben Crystal giving Hamlet's famous "to be or not to be" speech in reconstructed original pronunciation of the 17th century.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a say of troubles and by opposing, end them. To die, to slay, no more. And by a slave to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation to fountain to be washed.
So, wow, just listen to that. It sounds like a mixture of a whole bunch of different regional English accents with a bit of American thrown in there as well. It doesn't sound like anything that you would hear on its own today, and yet we can still hear ourselves today in it. Even that is still easily understandable to us today, 4 centuries after the fact. This gives you a sense for how long the time scales we're talking about here really are. If we can still make pretty solid sense of Shakespearean English from 400 years ago, then it stands to reason that Cicero and St. Augustine could have understood each other. The same goes for Augustine and Charlemagne. When we talk about the transformation from Latin to Romance, we're talking about a series of up and down, overlapping, ongoing processes that lasted for millennia. Latin wasn't static over centuries of use by millions of people. The shift into what we call the Romance languages was just a continuation of changes that had already been happening for centuries. Before we start to talk about those shifts, let's briefly go over the linguistic situation in the Roman Empire. It wasn't nearly as straightforward as we might think. In the early days of the Roman Republic, Italy was a tapestry of linguistic diversity. Latin was just the language of the city of Rome and its environs in the region of Latium. It had a closely related cousin, Faliscan, in the same region. More distantly related cousins like Oscan, Umbrian, and Volscian could be found elsewhere in Italy. These all belonged to the Italic language family, one of the branches of Indo-European that we talked about earlier. Just to the north of Rome were the Etruscans, who spoke a language totally unrelated to Latin. It wasn't Italic, and it wasn't even Indo-European. In the south of Italy and in Sicily were a number of Greek colonies. As you'd expect, they spoke Greek. As the Romans expanded outwards from the city into the peninsula, so did Latin. There's a famous saying that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. Language followed empire throughout first Italy, then beyond. Spain, North Africa, the Balkans, Gaul, and Britain all fell under Roman power. Latin went with the soldiers, merchants, and colonists who followed the expansion of Roman power. In the eastern Mediterranean, where Greek was the dominant language, Latin never really took hold. Even in the areas where Latin eventually became dominant, it wasn't the only language. In Africa, Punic went right on being spoken into the 4th or 5th century, if not even later. There were still Gaulish speakers in Gaul into the late empire. Latin obviously never fully displaced the Celtic languages of Britain, which became Welsh and Cornish. Today's Albanian is a descendant of an Indo-European language that survived right alongside Latin. In the East, where Latin never took hold, there was a wild amount of linguistic diversity that we don't fully need to explore here. So, this was the environment in which Latin was operating as the language of the Roman Empire, or at least the western part of the Roman Empire. This was the base from which the Romance languages sprang.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Latin wasn't static during the Roman Empire's time of dominance. Language is always changing. It always varies from place to place and social group to social group. Latin was no exception. It's not necessarily easy for us to tell precisely how Latin varied and changed over time, though. Obviously, we don't have sound recordings to tell us how people actually spoke Latin. Instead, we have to rely on written texts. But written texts can obscure as much as they tell us. You see, people don't write as they talk. You have to learn to write. You have to learn to spell. That process of learning, of being taught by someone who has themselves learned, obliterates a lot of the regional and social distinctiveness of language. We might use a dialect word or phrase in speech. If we were talking about the house on the opposite corner of the street, for example, I'd probably say kitty corner. I'd never write kitty corner, though. If I were writing about that same house on the opposite corner, I'd say diagonal. The same is true for spelling and pronunciation. Natives of London, Sydney, Calgary, or Los Angeles might all pronounce car a little differently, but we would all write it precisely the same. There's a written standard in English that admits only minor differences in spelling. Even leaving aside regional differences, nobody alive today pronounces English as they write it. We have a late Middle English orthography married to constantly evolving pronunciation. We say a word, not the letters that make it up. Latin's written standard was even more powerful than that of English today. It lasted for centuries, more or less unchanged, as long as the Latin educational system survived. To learn to write was to learn to write in a particular way. That particular way was based on the same curriculum and the same ideal of what Latin was supposed to look like. That's not to say the written language was always the same everywhere and at every time. It absolutely wasn't. It varied by educational level and by the kind of text we're talking about. But changes in the written language were often just that, changes in the written language. They weren't necessarily connected to shifts in how people were actually speaking the language. So, if written Latin is its own beast, what can it tell us about spoken Latin? Well, we have direct evidence of people talking about their language. They might mention particular words as belonging to particular regions. Sometimes they talk about accents, about sounds. Otherwise, consistent misspellings of words can point to the buried, underlying differences between pronunciation and writing. Inscriptions are common all over the Roman Empire. They can tell us a bit about regular speech, but not as much as scholars used to think. There are also some casual texts that are less influenced by the written standard that are pretty revealing about everyday speech. This category would include things like the papyri found in Egypt or the wooden tablets from the fort at Vindolanda on Hadrian's Wall in Britain. Scholars have carefully studied all of this evidence, and they've come up with some really interesting key points. I want to point in particular to the work of a scholar named J.N. Adams, who wrote a trio of definitive books on the actual use of Latin. Bilingualism in the Latin Language, The Regional Diversification of Latin, and Social Variation and the Latin Language. Adams is the OG of the field of Latin sociolinguistics, and his work looms over most of what I'm telling you here today. Read this whole section with his name in mind as a footnote. When we put all this together, what do we learn? Well, first and foremost, we learn that Latin did vary from social group to social group and place to place. There were accents and words that contemporaries thought were characteristic of particular places. We know that those patterns of accent, or how people perceived them, changed over time. In the Republic of the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, when Latin was mostly restricted to Italy still, people remarked on the difference between the city accent and the country accent of the surrounding region. In the Empire, as Latin spread across Europe and North Africa, folks mentioned features that they considered characteristic of whole regions outside Italy. When Latin moved into the provinces, it changed. Adams lists 5 reasons for this, and they're worth going over. First, when you put a language in a new physical environment, it has to adapt to topographical and biological features that don't exist in the homeland. Think about words like mesa or cougar in English. You didn't need terms for them back in Essex or Yorkshire. Second, provincial varieties of Latin came into contact with other vernacular languages. Punic in Africa, Gaulish in Gaul, Iberian in Spain, and so on. Those contacts could influence a whole array of things, from loanwords to pronunciation. Third, Latin back in the homeland didn't stop evolving once the language was planted in the provinces. There were changes in Latin in Italy that the provincial varieties didn't share, just like there are changes in England today that we don't share in America. Fourth, the reverse was also true. Provincial varieties of Latin could accumulate changes that the Latin of Italy didn't acquire. Fifth, and finally, there may be interaction between different dialects in the provinces. Speakers of multiple varieties of Latin came into contact with one another, and the features blended together. Regional variation in Latin matters because we know how this story ends, with Latin splintering into a whole array of regional Romance languages. If Latin already had regional variations in the first couple of centuries AD, does that mean the Romance languages were already developing during the Roman Empire? Well, a lot of scholars of Romance have argued for exactly that. By using the comparative method that we talked about in working backwards from the later Romance languages, they've made the case that there were already proto-Romance languages hiding underneath the written standard of Latin. Some have even argued that this process started as early as the 1st century BC. But this is almost certainly wrong. It's based on a lot of unfounded assumptions about language basically getting set at the moment it's introduced into a region and then evolving on its own, unconnected from what's going on elsewhere. There are also some weird ideas here about the relationship between the written standard and spoken language. Now, the flip side to this view is closer to the truth, but it's still kind of wrong, that there was a really homogeneous spoken Latin hiding underneath the written standard. Scholars of this particular viewpoint call this spoken language Vulgar Latin. Vulgar doesn't mean dirty, it just means belonging to the public or the people. In this view, Vulgar Latin, the spoken language, was the actual ancestor of Romance. It wasn't the written Latin of Cicero or Seneca. This makes sense in an intuitive kind of way. The language that the vast majority of the people are speaking every day is going to have more of an impact on the spoken language that evolves from it than a really restricted written standard. There were a lot of words and word meanings and usages that we know existed in spoken Latin that rarely made appearances in high-class written language. For example, the words that gave us hablar in Spanish and parler in French, to speak derive from terms that weren't used that way in classical written Latin. But there's a problem of evidence here. Most of the support for this vulgar Latin hypothesis, for the idea of a homogeneous spoken Latin everywhere throughout the empire, comes from inscriptions. We have tens of thousands of these inscriptions from the Roman Empire. That's a huge body of texts to work with. Given that volume, we might expect there to be real regional differences. But there aren't. This is why those scholars infer a pretty uniform spoken vulgar Latin across the empire. But it's easy to forget that inscriptions are still written text. They're not speech. People had to be taught how to write them. There were conventions of formula and spelling that went into inscriptions. Once again, the written standard obscures the actual fact of people's everyday speech. So, there wasn't a proto-Spanish and a proto-Italian and a proto-French running around the towns of Iberia, Italy, and Gaul during the Roman period. But there also wasn't a homogeneous vulgar Latin that was exactly the same in Rome, London, Carthage, and Merida. There really were regional varieties of Latin, but they were more what we'd think of as accents than genuine divergent dialects. Now, they're both kind of squishy terms, but dialect implies fairly deep differences in structure. Accent is more about sound and word choice. That's the middle ground that the most recent and the most thorough scholarship brings us to. So, what did that mean in practice? Well, it meant that Latin speakers had thoughts on what defined regional accents. Somebody from Rome could presumably tell that someone from Spain or Africa had a way of speaking that differed in meaningful ways from their own. They pronounced things differently. They used different words. Now, this isn't the same thing as anticipating the Romance languages that would eventually develop in those areas. When a Roman from Italy compared the way she spoke to the Latin of somebody from Gaul, it wasn't because she saw French coming 1,000 years down the road. It was because she had a concept of Gaul as a geographic region and a concept of Gauls as a people with notable characteristics. But let's get more concrete here. What kinds of differences do we actually see? Well, we see a lot of regionally specific words. There were quite a few of these, so we won't list them all. We see Deus instead of Deus for God in Britain. That's an influence from the native Celtic language. We see cerveza, beer, in Gallic Latin. That's a loanword from the Celtic Gaulish language. The word has survived to the present day in Spanish, but it was replaced by one of Germanic origin in French itself. The Latin of Northern Gaul and that of Britain seems to have shared a lot of similarities. They shared a common background. Related varieties of Celtic had been spoken there before the Roman conquest. They were also pretty close geographically and were a bit isolated from the rest of the empire, or at least the dominant Mediterranean part of it. Spanish and Italian Latin likewise had some distinctive features. The accent that attracted the most attention from contemporaries was the Latin of Africa. This Africitas, Africanness, was consistently noteworthy for centuries. Both outsiders and Africans themselves talked about it. The great St. Augustine, one of the most important Christian theologians, was a native of Hippo Regius in what's now Algeria. Writing in the 4th century, he said this, quote, "Should I say that you will easily attain a state of language free from faults of expression and pronunciation, I would certainly lie. For I myself, upon whom there has been a great compulsion to learn these things thoroughly, am still criticized by the Italians in the matter of many sounds within words, and they, in their turn, are criticized by me in the matter of sound. It is one thing to be secure in one's training, another in one's birth." Unlike the other varieties, where we mostly have evidence of particular words that stood out, we know that African Latin sounded different. Augustine tells us so, as we just heard. But what's very cool is that we know how it sounded different. So, Latin has vowels of variable length, long A, short A, long I, short I, and so on. A Latin speaker would distinguish between os, with a short vowel meaning bone, and os, with a long vowel meaning mouth. In the African variety of Latin, these distinctions between long and short vowels were lost. People like Augustine couldn't hear the difference, while people elsewhere in the empire still could. I mean, think about this. There are vowels in every word. Even educated speakers of African origin, like Augustine or the Emperor Septimius Severus, didn't make that distinction. You would have heard this every time somebody opened their mouth. So we know that there were regional varieties of Latin. Roman speakers of the language had accents and particular words that folks thought of as defining those regional varieties. We know this because dedicated research has laid out the scattered but substantial evidence for it. Social variation also played a role here. Writers occasionally commented on rustic or plebeian speech. Educated speakers of Latin were more aware of the standard of what proper Latin was supposed to sound like. There's evidence that they could shift their speech to accommodate it. I mean, this is true of speakers of practically all languages today, so this isn't really shocking. I know folks with PhDs whose language shifts depending on whether they're with their friends in private or speaking publicly to academic colleagues. I'm sure you can think of examples of you doing this yourself or of people who do. What all that evidence hasn't turned up is a lack of mutual intelligibility. As we've discussed, someone from Britain would have been aware that someone from Africa spoke Latin differently, but there's zero indication that the two couldn't have understood each other. Why is that? How, in an empire that stretched from Britain to the Sahara in its Latin-speaking parts, how could everybody understand each other? The answer to that question lies in a term called koinization. It comes from the Greek word koine, which means a standard language or dialect that comes about through the mixing of a bunch of dialects or varieties of that language. A classic example of this process is the version of the Greek language that came about during the Hellenistic period, after Alexander the Great's conquests. This was when the dialects of classical Greek all got mixed together into a new and widely intelligible standard. During the Roman Empire, in those first few centuries AD, Latin was constantly undergoing this process of koinization. The reason folks from Britain and North Africa, from Spain and the Balkans, could all understand each other was because people were constantly moving within the Roman Empire. We've talked about this before. Remember the episodes on cities and the volume of trade between them? Well, trade goods didn't move on their own. People had to move them. Merchants, sailors, and carters were always traveling from port to port, city to city. Soldiers were constantly in motion, moving from one posting to the next. Government officials and tax collectors were always on the road attending to official business. Slaves obviously weren't making the choice to move, but they too were mobile people within the Roman Empire. Others moved from province to province for voluntary reasons. The long and the short of it is that the Roman Empire has to be understood as a space of movement. The empire encouraged and enabled that movement. This has clear implications for the Latin language. Regional varieties of Latin, the accents that we talked about earlier, were constantly coming into contact with one another. They weren't isolated. Through that constant contact, they were leveling out the major differences between regions. Now, Latin wasn't the same everywhere. There were real, noticeable differences in accent and word choice. Regional and local varieties were always evolving in the Roman Empire. But because of that constant movement of people, the variations never became too large.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
The end of the Roman Empire as a political unit eventually brought about the end of the Roman world as a space of movement and interaction. The direct action of the state in moving goods like grain and olive oil through the tax system and people through the army came to an end. So too did the environment it had created, which made it easy for private individuals to move around within that space. Over the course of the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, it got harder and harder to move around. Trade slowed from a flood to a tiny trickle. Roman provinces turned into barbarian kingdoms. Borders hardened. This was actually the subject of my doctoral dissertation, so it's a topic I've spent a lot of time on over the years. The implication of this shift from a world of easy movement to one of difficult movement is clear. Latin had retained its essential unity because people from all over the Roman world were constantly coming into contact with one another. When that contact stopped, it was only a matter of time before Latin splintered. Lo and behold, that's eventually what we see. This was a slow process, though. For that matter, so was the end of the Roman Empire. As I've now spent 30-something episodes over a couple of different shows talking about, it wasn't an event, but a long series of interlocking things that played out over the course of centuries. In that vein, the kind of movement that had defined the Roman world and had kept Latin pretty homogeneous didn't die out overnight. But, as it had before, Latin kept evolving. We can see that evolution in the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries. The written standard was there, just as it had been all along. You can read an early medieval Latin text and not think that all that much had changed. There were still folks teaching how to write Latin in ways that weren't all that different from a couple of centuries before. Maybe the Bible became a little more influential, maybe fewer people were reading Cicero, but otherwise, not that much had really changed. My favorite text from this period is by Bishop Gregory of Tours in Gaul. He wrote around the end of the 6th century. Right off the bat, Gregory apologizes for his rough, unpolished language. Really, though, it's perfectly intelligible. He's not Cicero or Tacitus, but he's not an illiterate, and Gregory knew that. The continuing power of the written standard worked really hard to obscure the developments in the spoken language that lay underneath all of that seeming continuity. But there were things happening underneath the written standard. We can see that a bit in some fascinating texts from 7th century Spain. They're called the Visigothic Slates, Las Pizarras Visigodas, and they're a collection of a few dozen informal texts scratched into slate tablets. Some of them are bills of sale and contracts. Others are legal declarations, and there's even a letter in there. Because they're informal texts, everyday kinds of things, they're less influenced by the written standard. In these slates, we see characteristics that we know show up in the Romance languages later. Without going too deep down a technical rabbit hole, these are things like the use of definite articles, ille and ipse to mean the, and lots of prepositions. Latin didn't need those because it had a case system. You changed the ending of a word to denote what function it served in a sentence. We still have a couple of remnants of this in English. Who as a subject of a sentence versus whom as an object, and I versus me. Those are good examples. So let's use Dominus, Lord, as an example in Latin. If Dominus is the subject of the sentence, it takes the nominative form. We just say Dominus. If it's the direct object of the sentence, it takes the accusative form. We'd say Dominum. If we're talking about something that belongs to the Lord, say the Lord's horse, it takes the genitive case. We'd say Domini. What about the indirect object if we want to give something to the Lord? Then it would take the dative case. We'd say domino. When that system started to fall out of use, suddenly you needed definite articles and more prepositions. You couldn't just change the ending of the word to denote its meaning. You needed helper words. This isn't some kind of degeneration, no matter what the language purists might say. English went through the same process a long, long time ago. Practically all languages have dropped or at the very least simplified the case system because it's way simpler to use prepositions. It's essential to note that these kinds of usages had absolutely existed in Latin, too. What was changing was the frequency of their use. There was no hard line between Latin and the Romance languages. There was no definite tipping point. There was just a gradual shift over a long period of time. The folks who wrote those Visigothic slates weren't aware that they were writing something that was on its way to becoming Romance. As far as they were concerned, they were just writing Latin. This is essential to note. For a while, scholars of Romance in this period argued for a situation of diglossia. That means two languages were both in use in the same social group at the same time. According to this view, the educated were still speaking and writing Latin, but everybody else was already speaking Romance. In the mildest form of this argument, it meant that people were aware of a difference between their written language and their spoken language. But there's no reason to think this was the case. No matter how much the spoken language changed, the written language was still recognizably Latin. We have no evidence to suggest that people saw some sort of conceptual distinction between the two. This goes a step further, though. A really sharp French scholar named Michel Bagnard wrote a great book called Viva Voce on this topic back in the 90s. Bagnard proved that there was no conceptual distinction between Romance and Latin. How did he prove this? By showing that people who were writing texts at this point expected them to be understandable when read aloud. This sounds basic, but it's a key point. Let's say you're a bishop in Gaul in the 7th century. You know a holy person, a saint. You want to compose a life of that saint, a vita, to instruct the faithful in what it means to be a good Christian. But if you're writing Latin and the people don't speak Latin, how can that work? The answer is, it can't work. And yet, plenty of folks went on writing texts in a language that was obviously Latin, and they were meant to be read aloud to an illiterate audience. These folks weren't wasting their time writing something that nobody could understand in a language that was only accessible to the educated elite. But we still know that the spoken language was changing all the time. How did this work? The solution that Bagnard and other scholars have advanced to explain this is simple. When someone read Latin aloud, they simply pronounced the word the way they normally would in speech. We do this every time we read English aloud. We pronounce the word, not the letters that make up the word, as individual sounds. This kind of creative pronunciation could go a long way toward keeping written Latin and spoken Latin as the same language. Despite all this, the written language was, in fact, changing over all this time. We know this because of repeated spelling mistakes that start to creep into texts over the course of this period. There was even more confusion about the case system, which I mentioned earlier. Particular words and formulations fell out of use. Other words changed their meanings. Around the beginning of the 9th century, according to a really sharp scholar named Roger Wright, there was an actual turning point in terms of how people thought about the relationship between Latin and what they were speaking. Funnily enough, it didn't come from native speakers of the Latin/Romance languages on the continent. It came from Anglo-Saxon monks, natives of Britain, who had learned Latin as a foreign language in the monastery. So, the great Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne, who ruled at the end of the 8th century and the beginning of the 9th, well, Charlemagne was a busy man. In addition to conquering huge stretches of territory from Iberia to modern-day Germany, he launched an educational reform. This was part of the cultural efflorescence that scholars call the Carolingian Renaissance. We don't need to dig too deep into all of that, but for our purposes, here's the important part. To staff his new educational facilities and bring everything up to the standard, Charlemagne imported learned monks from Britain, especially a guy named Alcuin. Alcuin was an Anglo-Saxon. He grew up speaking Old English, and he only learned Latin as a second language. When he learned to speak Latin, Alcuin learned to pronounce every individual sound. It'd be like saying the word individual in that sentence as individual, with every letter getting exactly the same phonetic value instead of pronouncing the shape of the word as a whole, as we do. When he read, that's how he did it. Alcuin didn't change his pronunciation the way a native speaker and reader of the language would have, the way we've talked about here. So let's make this concrete. Let's take the word corpus, body. The plural of corpus is corpora, but a native speaker in the 9th century probably would have said something like corpa or cuerpa instead, maybe even corpus. Compare that to corpora. That difference would have driven Alcuin nuts. To him, what the natives of Gaul and Iberia and Italy were speaking wasn't Latin. What he had learned in the monastery, where every letter on the page was an individual sound, that was Latin. According to that scholar Roger Wright, this was the transformational moment that split Latin from Romance. If you were going to be educated according to Alcuin's formula, you couldn't read texts with the old word-for-word pronunciation. You had to read every letter. Suddenly, what you were reading off the page wasn't intelligible to the masses anymore. This was the separation point between medieval Latin, the Latin of the church and beyond, and the Romance languages. The first full text that we see that looks recognizably like a Romance language, and not Latin with updated pronunciation, is called the Strasbourg Oaths. This is a remarkable trilingual text from the year 842. Part of it is in Latin, part of it is in Old High German, and part is in what's obviously a Romance language. Two kings of the Carolingian dynasty, Louis the German and Charles the Bald, got together to swear allegiance to one another against their brother Lothair. I'm going to read a selection to you so you can get a sense for what this emerging Romance language sounded like. If you know some Latin or some of a Romance language, you'll probably be able to pick out a bunch of words that sound familiar to you, but it's going to sound a little weird. Give it a listen. Pro Deo amor et pro Christian poblo et nostro comun salvament, diest di enavant, in quant Deus savir et podir me donat, si salvarai eo quist meon frodre Carlo, et in adiuda et in caduna cosa sicum om perdret son fradra salvardift, ino quid il me altresse facet. Et ab luder null plaid nunquam prindrae qui meon vols quist meon frodre Carlo in damno sit. This is pretty obviously not what we'd think of as Latin. All across what had been the Roman Empire, Latin was evolving into Romance. The Romance languages that emerged didn't look the same everywhere, though. There were increasing differences between how people spoke in southern Italy and how they spoke in northern France. Eventually, the time was coming when they wouldn't be able to understand each other, though that point still probably wasn't in the 9th century. So, why was that? In large part, it's just the natural consequences of time when those varieties weren't in contact with each other. Languages always have a bunch of ways of saying the same thing. In Spanish, for example, you'd say su to denote a possessive adjective. In French, it's luro. The former comes from Latin suus, the latter from ilorum, of those ones. Both work just fine in Latin. But over time, people in particular places tend to favor one usage over another, and the other way fell out of use. The same held true for sound changes, for changes in syntax and vocabulary. If you stack up enough of those changes on top of one another, eventually you're going to get major differences. But even after the 9th century, with Alcuin and his educational reform, that didn't mean that the distinction between Latin and Romance was set in stone. There definitely weren't distinctions between varieties of Romance at this point either. The final split wouldn't take place until the 12th or the 13th century. That's 800 years after the Roman Empire ceased to be a going concern. The 12th or the 13th century was when the emerging kingdoms of the High Middle Ages created their own chanceries and started using a particular vernacular language, a variety of romance. The fact that the chancery used that particular vernacular helped to make it a written standard with its own rules. Even so, as the languages diverged, they didn't diverge that much or all at once. Let's say you started in the very north of the Romance-speaking area along the North Sea and then headed south around 1200. You'd pass through what's now Belgium into northern France, then into southern France in either Italy or Spain. As you walked from village to village, town to town, the language would change, a little at a time. If you compared the dialect of southern Spain or southern Italy to that of northern France, you'd notice substantial differences. But if you compared one village to the next, they'd be really close. In essence, the Western Romance languages formed a dialect continuum. Some would say they still do, even after the introduction of national educational standards in the 19th and 20th centuries. If we squint hard enough, if we made that long walk today, the ancient unity of Latin might still be with us, even now. Latin exploded outwards from Italy, along with Roman imperial power and the Romans themselves. It established itself all over the western provinces, from the fringes of the Sahara to the moors of Scotland and the forests of Germany. As the Roman Empire split apart, so did the essential unity of Latin. The same way folks like you and I make choices every day about words to use, people in this period did the same thing. Millions of those choices over hundreds of years were what transformed Latin into Spanish, Portuguese, Occitan, French, Walloon, Italian, Sardinian, Romanian, and many more. These weren't the direct descendants of regional varieties of Latin. They were something different. A lot happened after the end of the Roman Empire, and the wild diversity of the Romance languages is a reflection of it. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this as much as I enjoyed researching the topic and writing the episode. It's something I've been interested in for a really long time, and it's a pleasure putting this together. Thanks so much for joining me today. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be looking at the great Roman Emperor Justinian, the last of the Romans, as some have called him. From his base in Constantinople, Justinian did his best to reconquer the lost provinces of the West in the middle of the 6th century. He succeeded, kind of, but the Roman world was slipping away. How and why all that went down will be our next topic. When we return to Rise of the Modern World in January, we'll be covering something I'm really stoked to dig into. The Renaissance, that great efflorescence of culture, learning, and art. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to talk about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, or TuneIn. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez. The associate producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History. Thank you.